Welcome to Patients at Risk, a discussion of the dangers that patients face when physicians are replaced with non-physician practitioners. I'm Dr. Rebecca Bernard, your host and the co-author of the book Patients at Risk, The Rise of the Nurse Practitioner and Physician Assistant in Healthcare. There is no doubt that America is facing a physician shortage, due in large part to a lack of residency positions, the mandatory 1 to 3 years that medical school graduates must complete to receive a license to practice medicine. Today, we are talking about a proposed solution to this problem, a new professional designation for unmatched medical school graduates called the Assistant Physician, or AP. Today, in part one of our discussion of the assistant physician role, I am joined by Dr. Keith Frederick. He's an orthopedic surgeon and a former legislator in the state of Missouri, and he was a big part of the creation of this role for the first time in the state of Missouri. And we're also joined by a physician who benefited from this role, Dr. Liz Troilo. Well, Dr. Frederick, tell us about what made you passionate about trying to advocate, and actually even start us out even before that. What is the assistant physician role as you've imagined it and as it is actually active now?
Well, you know, we have such a shortage of physicians and just medical access. In Missouri, at the time I was submitting this, 110 of our 114 counties were HPSA areas, health profession shortage areas. And it wasn't fixing to get any better because at that time, we were looking at the baby boomers coming to the age where they were going to need a lot more care. We were looking at the continued impact of the introduction of computerized, medicine and EHRs. And a lot of docs were struggling with that and their productivity was going down. We also were seeing and continue to see, happily, more women in medicine. My daughter is a family practice doc, by the way. And she's chosen to just work 3 days a week, is raising a family, is very happy with that. It's a very successful practice. Patients love her. But this combination of things was kind of like a perfect storm. You have the rising need for medical care, and you have diminished access to providers. And those providers that are there are not quite as productive as in the past. Maybe that's an oversimplification. But at any rate, we saw that in Missouri, there were counties where access to medical care was really bad. And so other representatives in the Missouri House and I discussed this whole concept of what can we do to help, at least in Missouri, get people access to better medical care and make it more accessible. Well, about that time, the Missouri State Medical Association, our state organization for MD physicians, through their House of Delegates, came a resolution with this basic idea of, let's look at unmatched applicants to residencies and see if there's some way to tap into that resource. So, man, when I first saw that resolution, it was like, this is brilliant, because you have all these hopeful doctors who, they're doctors, but they're not trained doctors yet. They graduate from medical school and in good standing. You know, it's not like they're bottom of the heap. You know, they passed everything that was required of them, and including graduating from medical school in good standing, passing their boards, and couldn't get a residency because the basic fact is there just aren't enough residencies. It's not that we don't have enough qualified applicants. We had plenty of qualified applicants. We just don't have enough residency slots. And that goes back to the funding. You know, the federal government basically funds the majority of residencies. And it was back many years ago that the funding for that was frozen. And as the need for physicians has grown, the training programs haven't grown. Although state legislatures across the country have said, oh, we've got a problem. We don't have enough docs. Well, let's increase the class size in medical schools. In fact, let's build some more medical schools. Good idea, but it's not the bottleneck. That's not the bottleneck. The bottleneck was not enough investment in residency training programs. And so this concept of using docs that are graduates of medical school, highly qualified, and in debt. You know, a lot of these young people are, it's kind of like having a mortgage, but no house and no job to pay the mortgage. In fact, there's a significant mental health toll on folks that have this big debt and try again to get into a residency program and aren't able to do it. I mean, imagine the burden that that would place on you and your family.
Yeah. So that's actually the question I would ask Dr. Troilo. Do you feel that you would have not matched that first time and that doing this AP role is what allowed you to be able to then match?
My biggest hurdle was that I finished my third year of medical school in September, and that's when, you know, applications are due. So I didn't have step two completed. Given how competitive everything is now, even if, you know, it's family medicine, psychiatry, whichever fellowship, residency, anything you're looking at these days, it's so competitive that a half finished application was not something I was willing to bet on, especially because it's so difficult if you don't match that first time. So the assistant physician position was definitely something that I think opened doors for me. I know for a fact that I actually received a couple of my invitations specifically for interviewing for residency, specifically because of that. I will say there's also a little bit of, confusion as to what the position is. And even from physicians themselves, there was a lot of pushback for that position as well. So the AAFP has a big conference every year in the end of July in Kansas City that we went to as medical students and as residents. And so I went and I met with as many people as I could. And I actually had a couple of program directors push back and say, oh, no, I won't interview you because you've been an AP, because they felt like I was skirting the system is what one specifically told me. So there's been, you know, pushback in different directions. But, you know, I also got interviews because of it and a lot of, you know, interested parties because they wanted to know more about it. So I think it definitely helped. And I went into residency, almost practicing like a third year resident in certain aspects too, because I had my own patient panel and I had done enough deliveries and participated in enough C-sections and things like that, that, you know, an intern versus a third year, kind of just those numbers and repetitions. So that was also very helpful.
So just for our listeners who are just learning about this, many of them have heard of it, but the assistant physician role is mm-hmm. for a graduate of medical school, mm-hmm. and it is for them to work under the supervision of a licensed physician. And in the state of Missouri, I don't believe that there's a time period, but in most states, it's only a 1 or maybe a 2 year period, and it's more intended to be a stopgap in between residency. Although Missouri, I think you can continue on. Am I getting that right, Dr. Frederick?
Yes. In Missouri, I never did intend to put any sort of time limit on it, because as you continue to perform in this role, you would only get better. You wouldn't get any worse. And just as Dr. Troilo was discussing, as she had more repetition, she had more exposure, she's going to be more qualified at the end of a year or two or three. So the idea of time limiting it, I don't know of any other professional license that comes with an expiration date. I mean, should your engineering license, should pick any other license, your dental license, should it come with an expiration date? In my view, that's just backward thinking to make it an expiration date. In fact, even though it often leads to transition to a residency, it doesn't have to. Someone may decide in their personal situation, they don't want to go into a very grueling 3 or 4 or 5 years of additional medical training. And who's to say that they shouldn't be able to stop at that level and practice like another extender or mid-level?
They're still under the supervision of a physician on an ongoing basis. So that actually might be a win-win for both people in that relationship.
Absolutely. You know, one other point I wanted to make, so I don't forget it. Another thing that I did in Missouri, as we were the first state, is I made it so that you would still qualify if you had not finished a residency, if you had not graduated from a residency. Because much of my activity, my first few years in the house in Missouri, were regarding medical student well-being and mental health and suicide prevention. In fact, when I was first elected, I was the only physician in the Missouri House of Representatives that had 163 members. And so if an individual is really struggling in the residency, and you know, there's all too many residents with depression, anxiety, suicidal tendencies, and even suicide. So if you're in that category, I think it's much better to take some time off and work under the protective wing of a licensed physician and get your legs underneath you again, you know, kind of get things squared away. It might even be life-saving. And so if you're in a residency that you're struggling with and you just want some time out of that, Missouri or other states, there are a number of other states now that have this type of program.
I think you're making such an important point because you're 100% right. Depression rates are extraordinarily high among medical students and residents, and physician suicide is just a tragedy. So I love this, that there's an option, because we know that in most states, I don't know what Missouri is, but most states require a minimum of 1 year of residency for U.S. trained and 3 years for non-U.S. trained, and many states require a complete 3 year residency. So, which is so interesting to me, because some of those same states will allow a nurse practitioner full practice authority or independent practice after, you know, X number of hours. So it's very ironic to me. So I think it's so important that we have these alternate pathways. Dr. Troilo, what are your thoughts when you hear about that aspect?
I think it's interesting because I think an assistant physician that my mentor kind of had after me, she was actually in a surgical residency and then decided about, I think, year two that that was not the life for her. And she ended up going in and working as an assistant physician because of life circumstances and then kind of transitioned to family medicine residency afterwards. But there, you know, there are other assistant physicians through a network that I've met, and some of them, there are two that I can think of at the top of my head that is as far as they want to go. So they are comfortable being assistant physicians for the duration of their careers. And it is, you know, a really good spot for them. They still have the education of 4 years and the rigors of medical school and all of the boards that they took and all of that kind of under their wing. So they have that, you know, advantage of having compared to other, you know, mid-levels, if we can call them that. So they have all of that under their belt, which, you know, to me just provides a higher level of understanding. And so it's definitely a good option. I know that I got paid for my role. It wasn't a whole lot, but it was definitely, I was able to afford an apartment and live in a community. And the thought for some of us that went to like DO schools or international schools, the $200,000 that we talk about is actually a fraction of what we are behind on when we talk about how much loans we have. Most of us who are international medical graduates from like the big four schools have more than $500,000 in debt. And that's, you know, when you're trying to pay those loans back or even thinking about it, if you don't match, you know, it's absolutely devastating, because not only have your dreams kind of crumbled, now you're sitting with, again, a mortgage without a house or any way to kind of substantiate that kind of debt that you've kind of landed yourself in. So one of my friends actually ended up working at a Starbucks and then applied for an assistant physician job. And she's now an OBGYN. But yeah, so it's, you know, a great option. And I'm sure thankful and that, you know, you thought about that part of resident and medical student well-being and mental health.
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Frederick, I just want to tell you how much I appreciate your work. And I also think our listeners can recognize the value of having physicians in our legislature, because this is really where these things happen. And what I read in a news article about it was that you got this passed the same year that it was introduced, which was described as a remarkable feat. And this was despite some pushback from organized medicine, and I'm guessing from non-physician practitioner lobbies. Can you talk about some of that pushback that you got and how you were able to get this legislation through?
Yes. It was a very unusual accomplishment, and it was just a combination of events that led to it getting through the first time. You know, you can get a highway named after someone the first year, but when you're undertaking a new licensing act, that's a major thing that usually would take two, three, 4 years to accomplish. But there were several things that happened. I was able to work with the minority party and leadership in the minority party. And the concept was what really swayed people. It's like, we have this tremendous workforce, highly qualified, and we have this tremendous need in our state. So that was the starting point. I did, however, encounter some other representatives, but one senator in particular I can recall, who wasn't real familiar with medical education and asked me how I thought that these individuals, through working underneath this physician in a supervisory capacity, how could they ever get up to the level of a nurse practitioner? In order to win her over, I had to first suppress any thought of, you know, giggling about it or, you know, just finding it amusing. But I did just go back to the basic fundamentals about how many hours of training are involved and the level of difficulty of getting through medical school and then taking your boards. And I just went through the medical education process. And after a while, she did understand that, oh, well, these folks are actually more qualified than the others who are filling such a role. But, you know, some of the ways that the legislation moved through the process are kind of like inside baseball. And if you haven't been in a legislature, it wouldn't really mean all that much to you. Although I would relate this. There was a physician in the Senate. I was in the House. Of course, you have to have a sponsor in the Senate to have it really have a chance. And he was very much in favor of it. He saw it just like I did. But to kind of get him interested in championing it and really, you know, putting his effort into it, I told him he could name the physician. We didn't have a name for him at the beginning. And so we, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning and we're bantering about, like, what should we call him, you know? And he came up with the idea of assistant physician. I said, you know, it's gonna be a little confusing with PAs. Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be different enough, you know, we'll be able to. And so I went with it, and his name was Senator Rob Schaff. And he was very instrumental in helping us get this through the legislature in Missouri the first year. Well, things that I wish I had done a little bit differently, because it was the first state and I wanted to give it the best chance of, you know, getting across the finish line, I made it fairly narrow and focused. I wasn't swinging for the fences. I was going for a good single or double, not a grand slam home run. But I wish I had not limited it to just primary care. You know, I'm in orthopedics. I could have used a AP in my orthopedic practice right from the get-go. And there's a need for that all over the state, too. You know, most of the specialties, we do see that there are mid-level or extenders in the specialties. And I wish I had made it so that they could work in any field, particularly psychiatry. There's such a need now for mental health. And I wish that they were able to work in mental health capacity. Another thing that didn't work out as well as I had hoped, even though I tried, was reimbursement. Mm-hmm. Probably the major challenge we have in Missouri is that we don't receive Medicare reimbursement. We do get Medicaid reimbursement that helps a great deal. But Medicare is followed by a lot of the third-party health insurance, the Blue Cross, Blue Shield, the Uniteds, and so forth. And if Medicare doesn't reimburse, then generally the others don't either. And I went to legislative research that helped me draft the legislation and told them what my goal was to get reimbursed for these folks, you know, for their efforts to patient care by Medicare. And they came up with a method that, and this is an individual that had 25 years experience writing legislation for the state of Missouri, and she assured me it would work just fine. Well, after we got it passed and after it took almost two and a half years to get it implemented, long story there, but it, you know, there was a lot of attempt to really limit it in the rule promulgation process. You know, the ivory tower entities were trying to have their effect and really minimize the ability of these APs to succeed. But anyway, once it got through that process and out in practice, people tried to apply for reimbursement from Medicare. Medicare looked at our language in the legislation and said, that's all very nice, but we're not going to do it. And so I've been working ever since. I have some folks that I served with in the Missouri legislature who are now in the U.S. Congress. And I'm working through them and others to try to achieve Medicare reimbursement. Once that occurs, I think the assistant physician program is off to the races. I think it will be tremendously successful. It does have some success now, but after that reimbursement hurdle is won, I think that will be a real boon to access to healthcare in rural Missouri and in underserved areas, not just rural, but inner city as well.
So right now, an AP cannot see a Medicare patient at all, or would it bill under the supervising physician, Dr. Troilo?
So I did see Medicare patients. Unfortunately, we were an FQHC lookalike. We just didn't get reimbursed for it. So my my mentor, she had one of the, I think, last large private practices, and she ended up actually eating a lot of costs for any Medicare patients that I saw. I ended up, because of the OB work I did, ended up having a lot of Medicaid patients, which was really helpful to kind of balance that out. But yeah, if I saw Medicare patients, I didn't mean to get reimbursed for them.
You know, other practice settings that work well are direct primary care, where it's a subscription-based compensation, and cash, you know, like urgent care, that sort of thing, where it's a cash basis. But it doesn't really replace the void of not having Medicare reimbursement.
Right. That's a pretty big gap. And I happen to be a family doctor, and I happen to do direct primary care. And looking for a physician to join my practice in Florida, if we had this, I would absolutely be looking for that person, because we definitely have a shortage. And I am definitely pro-physician, so I'm always trying to advocate just like you, Dr. Frederick. And speaking of that, tell me about, I find what you said about the senator who really was confused about education. Tell me, why do you think it is that she believed that an NP had more training than a graduate physician? And is that something that you experience commonly?
Well, I think it's reflective of the fact that there are enough nurse practitioners and PAs, and they have organized, and they have dues, and they therefore have lobbyists. And the lobbyists are very prominently featured in the capitals. And so I'm sure this individual had been lobbied by the representatives of their organizations and touted their, you know, qualifications and accomplishments. Now, I don't want to run them down because, hey, they are valuable members of the healthcare team and have good contributions to make. But I would say that the graduate physician, the assistant physician, on paper, has considerably more training. And so you don't have to think poorly of NPs or PAs to acknowledge that the assistant physician simply has more hours of training and more experience.
And I will say that after about 6 months of me practicing, there was a special counsel that got together and had me come and speak. And so I went and spoke about it and my experience. And then not to my surprise, there were representatives from both the PA state committee as well as the NP state committee who came and spoke against it again regarding what their thoughts were. And surprisingly for me, some of the local medical schools, some representatives from medical schools came and spoke against it as well. So it was my first formidable experience in state legislative process. So yeah, it was interesting who was pro and who wasn't.
You know, I just think a lot of the opposition from organized medicine, I'm sorry to say it, but I think they're just pulling the ladder of success up behind them. You know, I think it's really a turf protection thing, when actually we should be trying to support our profession, support these individuals that have worked so hard. They've sort of been betrayed. It's kind of like musical chairs. They did everything was asked of them, passed everything, didn't flunk out. They did great, but there aren't enough spots for them. So we should take it upon ourselves as physicians to help members of our profession. I think when you matriculate, and then certainly when you graduate, you're part of the noble profession of medicine. And we should do everything we can to help them along. They're in debt. Their dreams are crashing on the shore. And we have it within our capability to help them. We should do it.
There's a lot more to come in this discussion in part two, which is our next episode. In the meantime, I thank you for listening. And if you'd like to learn more about this topic, I encourage you to get the book Patients at Risk, The Rise of the Nurse Practitioner and Physician Assisted in Healthcare, and my follow-up book, Imposter Doctors, Patients at Risk. Those are both available at Amazon and at barnesandnoble.com. And if you're a physician and you'd like to learn more about getting involved with our mission, which is to advocate for physician-led care for all patients and truth and transparency among healthcare practitioners, please join the group Physicians for Patient Protection. You can learn more at our website, physiciansforpatientprotection.org. Thanks so much, and we'll see you on the next podcast.